This podcast is sponsored by Clicktel Web Analytics. Record and watch movies of your website visitors' actual browsing sessions. See every mouse move and every click, as if you're looking over their shoulder. Discover how to maximize your site's profitability and improve usability by visiting clicktel.com today. By The Optimal Workshop, find out just how good your information architecture is and know what to tweak with TreeJack. The Optimal Workshop's tools can help make your website easier to use. And by Rosenfeld Media. Find short, practical, and useful books and webinars on user experience design. Enter IA Podcast as your discount code and receive 20% off all purchases. Visit rosenfeldmedia.com today.
This is the IA Podcast. Today is Tuesday, August 3rd, 2010. Welcome to the show where I talk with Dorian Taylor about working in the post-industrial era. Welcome back to the show, everyone. As always, my name is Jeff Parks, and I'm your host for the IA Podcast. A couple of quick announcements before we get to today's show. First of all, I'm looking for UX professionals around the world to host conversations on Radio Johnny over on Johnny Holland. My long-term goal is to get people producing shows consistently on every continent around the world about user experience-related topics. I think there's a hard focus on what's going on maybe in North America, but there's not a greater understanding of what's happening in places like Germany and Italy and other places like that. So I'd like more people to be involved in the discussions. So if you're interested, please drop me a note. The Follow the UX Leader workshops on writing for the web, user experience design, and information architecture that my colleague Christina Mauser and I at Digital Word are putting together start on September 21st with Christina leading a workshop on writing for the web. September 22nd is the workshop I'll be leading on user experience design. And on October 19th, I'll be leading a session on information architecture. To learn more, visit followtheuxleader.com. We've been absolutely blown away by our sponsors and their generosity. Loop 11, The Optimal Workshop, Clicktel Web Analytics, Morgan Kaufman, Rosenfeld Media, Fat Ducks, MarsWorks, and the IAI have all offered services and products to every participant that literally cover off the cost of the workshop at a $550 per student. In other words, the value of the products and services are actually greater than the cost of the workshop itself that you'll be given. In addition, we have folded in the tools and services offered by our sponsors into every workshop, so participants will have context to how to use the tools and services when they have the chance to use them back in their own organization. Also, we'll be donating a portion of the profits from each workshop to Causeway Work Center here in Ottawa, a nonprofit organization I had the privilege of working for a few years back, who help those who cannot help themselves find employment and education opportunities, including the homeless and the mentally ill. So in short, everyone in our community can and will benefit from these experiences of the workshops. So we hope to see you sign up soon. Again, space is limited. There are only 20 spots per workshop, and that's to encourage the interaction that you'll be having with other participants to learn not only from Christina and myself, but from others who are attending each workshop. So today's show, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dorian Taylor. Dorian is an independent creative professional who invents something new every day. He can normally be found around the ugly problems of enterprise information infrastructure, employing a cocktail of experience and self-taught understanding in visual design, programming, information architecture, and a dash of InfoSec paranoia. He currently maintains a low profile, hard at work designing a deal that affords creative work without compromise, amassing mountains of text, defining a web infrastructure to manage it all the while making time to help out a few select clients. Now, this is not a show that you want to listen to, sort of to have on the background to pick up a few key points. The original conversation was over 2 hours. I've edited it down to about an hour and a half. But the ideas that Dorian shares, in my professional opinion, are absolute. They're a necessity to moving us from the post-industrial era into an understanding of the knowledge economy. So a few of the key points that Dorian talks about in this particular show are, as I mentioned, working in the post-industrial era, iteration versus incrementalism, the physics of information, how ordinary people are becoming producers, and the impact that has on the knowledge economy, how we need to focus more on empathy and understanding the needs of the people for whom we're designing and the services we're offering, and the subsequent support that is being provided by companies, or lack thereof, evidence versus testimony relating to experience in the information age, and how the fact that we're really medium-sized creatures and we can only truly understand medium-sized stuff. I want to thank Dorian personally for all of his time. This is an incredible experience. I learned a lot from Dorian in this conversation, and I really hope that people will take the time to listen to this and provide feedback, either in comments to me or in communicating with Dorian himself in the near future. So I hope everybody enjoys the podcast. Cheers.
We've had computers for like 60 years now, and like there's this sort of bifurcation of, you know, the people that can work and use them, and by that I mean like program them straight up, and then the people that can't. And it's strange to me. I mean, if you look at it, you can actually see how it's almost been kept away from people, and you know, programming languages have been almost made intentionally hard, and where they've been made easy, they've been gelded so that they're not, you can't actually do anything with them, like Logo or Alice, or, you know, I mean, they're good for teaching, but that's about it. And what I would really like to see is a sort of a ubiquity in actually working with software, you know, because I mean, if you're moving a mouse, you're programming. You're using a very, very limited language, which just says X, Y, and click, but you are. And I mean, we don't really recognize that. It's sort of been this, let me get that for you, service design almost thing with a, you know, with the GUI and stuff like that to say, oh, you know, here's your desktop and your trash can and all that stuff, and here's some folders. So it's like there's this entire universe of people, oh, you know, I'm not computer literate, I don't know how to do this stuff. And it's like, you know, I really wish I could even start talking about, you know, even communicate this stuff. And it just sort of, so I've been trying to figure out like how to do that.
So yeah, it's almost sounds like a human factors approach. Like you're trying to understand, you know, how do people behave? How do they interact with technology? And even at a higher level, you know, looking at like in the notes you sent me, the idea looking at how we do these things in a post-industrial era, right, of revolution. Because I mean, like, putting part A, it's no longer about putting part A into part B to create part C. It's almost like you're creating 60 versions of part A plus 60 versions of part B, and then trying to see what pieces fit, and we could create a multitude of different solutions at the far end, but we can't do that in an intuitive way for people if we're continually to follow the sort of industrial factory mentality of when you put all the pieces together, at the end you get the Model T Ford, and it's only in black.
Right.
Right, that sort of thing,
yeah.
And then how can we get people to engage in this more? I mean, is the iPad getting closer to this touchscreen technology where it's no longer about the sort of metaphorical trash can on your desktop trying to mirror that to something more, well, real? Now I'm actually grabbing the photo like I would in the real world and making it more along those lines.
Yeah, ish.
Okay, cool.
Okay, it's good to think in those terms, like the something like an iPad is an incremental step, you know, and the best that we can actually do in a successful product is making an incremental step. You can't just go and make something completely alien and expect it to sell. The interesting thing about it is, you know, you look at, say, for example, like iBooks or whatever like that, and it like makes the fake page, then you like turn it with your finger, you know, and you. Now, that's kind of interesting that they can do that, but I mean, there was a really good idea with respect to metaphors and idioms with respect to user experience design. You know, it's in like About Face, Cooper, all of them, I think. And it's like, okay, you know, we've got this metaphor, and we've got like this picture of a desktop, like Microsoft Bob. Right. You know, we've got this picture of a desktop, and you like, you know, go to this room and that room, and it's like a game of Clue or something like that. And the thing about a metaphor, and I thought this was really kind of interesting, and I've sort of explored this a little bit. And the thing about a metaphor is that it isn't the referent, right? Like it's not the thing that you're talking about. It's just a It's a and what happens is when you stray away from what intersects between the metaphor and the referent, you get into the sort of no man's land. And then what happens is you come up with accidental idioms, like dragging the a disc to the trash to eject it. You know, and you've got this accidental idiom, and an idiom is something you have to learn. You have to, you know, it's not something that you can just take from one environment and apply it to another. You have to learn it. When I look at something like an iPad, and I see, oh, you know, that's cute. They've made pages that you can, you know,
yeah.
It's like, I kind of wonder, why are you making a book on a screen that looks like a book, you know, and it's like, and people are like, well, you know, the user's not going to understand, you know, make it for my mom. And I wonder, like, my mom's not that dumb. You know? And we've had this, you know, we've had this conversation going through the community back and forth about exactly, like, you know, about this. Now, the thing is like, when you start off with the metaphor and you go, okay, yeah, I get it. And then you get surprised, you know, something doesn't work as you expected it to. And then you have to figure out, like, you're all the way down to the sort of the basic algebra of physical, tangible interaction. All you know is that you can move stuff around with your finger and that's it. And then you're kind of lost, right? Anyway, I'm digressing all over the place here.
That's okay, man. That's great. I mean, it's true. It's like I've been talking about for the last few years. You know, like people, even a medium like this, like podcasting. I mean, they're just tools to connect you with other people, right? Mm-hmm. It's how do these things translate into the real world? And to your point with the iPad, do we need an application that creates an electronic digital book if we've got the physical asset in our hands? Like, why? What is it? Convenience? Is it because there's a need, or is it because now the technology allows us to do this, we should be doing this? And I don't hear enough people asking the question, why, often enough, right? Like, why are we implementing this tool into this design, into this tool, or this concept into what it is that we're trying to create?
I mean, if you think about the notion of the written word and about communication. I mean, think about what we've done with hypertext. I mean, have you looked at some of the really old stuff like Vannevar Bush and Ted Nelson? And
yeah.
You know, so we've got like a basic semantic unit, like a sentence, and that is one idea. I can communicate one idea with one sentence. Now, the shape of a book is completely accidental. If you think about how you put a book together, the reason why it is the way it is, it started off as a scroll, you know, and you just wrote, and you got to the end, you know, and you rolled it up or whatever. And then we sort of figured out the codex, and the codex, you know, is the book that we know as a book. And, you know, we just took the scroll and we chopped it up. And then we, for some reason, took the chopped up scroll and we put it into bits. And now we've got it on these like ridiculously complicated devices, and by that I just mean like just the supply chain, just getting the thing to, you know, the kind of technology that we've needed to concentrate the resources into the shape of something like a device like an iPad, and then we've got this completely ridiculous like linear ancient method of getting bits into brains on this like fantastically complex machine. And I kind of think to myself, it's like, okay, well, this thing is not a book, it's a computation, and we see this pattern a lot. We've got a good example and this is something that I've been working on for a bit, is the automobile. So the Daimler, you know, goofy thing that looks like a horseless carriage had like a stick to steer with. 20 years later, you got the Model T for it. So like between 1890 and 1910-ish, I don't know, I can't remember the exact dates, but like you've got this, you know, the UI for a car solidified in 20 years. The UI for a computer has been 60 plus years. We haven't figured out a way to do it. We've got this sort of we've got programming. Mm-hmm. And then we've got whatever the programmers make. And again, you know, one of the things that I say is that People don't do a lot of computation with their computers. What do they have for computation? Actual computation. I want to compute some data. I want to learn something. I mean, what have you got? Excel. When you have a computation, you're sort of amortizing complexity over time. It's this ability to transit between one shape and another shape, and you can branch off and do all sorts of wacky stuff with that. And we just don't offer that to people. Like, taking back to the book on the handheld electronic device, what if, let's say that you wanted to increase uptake. You wanted to get information into somebody's head. So you take this antiquated notion of providing uptake, and then you move it onto a machine that doesn't require that, and it doesn't require that particular ordering. I mean, if you think about expository text and what's in it, definitions of terms, introductions to concepts, and then an argument. And that's like maybe 5% of the entire thing. And the rest is just like fluff to try to set up the reader into understanding what that is.
Right.
So that they can, and it's like this sort of dump truck, unloading into the person's head all, in its specific order. The stuff closest to the tailgate goes in first, and the stuff closest to the end goes in last. But you don't have to do that. You can jump around. Like, the web is freaking awesome for that. But we're still making essays and pages and books and stuff on the web. I'm pointing at my web browser over here that you can see.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and it's gotten to the point, too. Like, a lot of what you're describing, too, is we haven't asked the question why. We're starting to slowly look at these things as tools, I think. But as you pointed out, if there's a trillion gigabytes of data on the web, I mean, you can't even wrap your head around that number and what that means. How do you pull out the meaningful information? How do you create designs? You've been pointing out the whole idea around the post-industrial revolution. We still think about the assembly line work. I mean, you pointed out in a note to me about how Agile is getting closer to sort of a post-industrial mindset and understanding, but we're still limiting ourselves to the box itself in a way, I think, like what's on the computer. And the computer can do a ton of things that it's really good for, but there's also a lot of stuff that technology is really, really, really bad at. Yet we try to sort of push technology to do things that, A, it was neither intended to do, the technology's not at that point, and it's actually creating, I think, a greater social disconnect between people, because now we can almost hide behind multiple iterations. We can hide behind sort of blog posts and Twitter and these other things without having to actually make those connections that you're describing, I think, in that context anyway.
We've got a couple things in here. First of all, we've still got the notion of the assembly line. Now, let me just address that quickly. In order to be able to deliver a result, you have to have an effective method for it.
Right.
And you have to have data about that method. Now, the thing is, like, we're making new stuff all the time that's completely unprecedented. We don't have an effective method. We may have an effective method for bits and pieces of it, but we don't have the sequence or order or anything like that. And, like, actually decomposing a completely wacky, there is no orientation. It's a graph. And decomposing that into a program, a linear program that you can run, and by that I mean like an actual project that people do, not a computer program, that is a hard, 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 hard problem. People have been working on that for decades, and I've been like trying to amass what they know about it so that I can actually like try to do that, because there has been some research on that. But anyway, so I don't think we really appreciate that. Now Agile, they've come a long way with trying to do that, because what they say is, we'll just get like a user story and we will just like iterate and make some stuff. And okay, now that's good, because now you're not trying to prescribe what you're going to do anymore. You can't prescribe what you don't know, which is the sort of the waterfall method. Now I kind of look at that as my experience, my personal experience programming in an agile environment is that iteration, there's two concepts. There's iteration and there's incrementalism. And incrementalism is like kind of, we make one piece and then we make another piece and then we compose those pieces together. And there's iteration where we say, okay, we're gonna make the entire thing and then we're gonna scrap it and make another thing and then we're gonna scrap that and make another thing. Now, even when you're talking about that at the level of code, like code, we have to understand, is like an extremely verbose, extremely precise incantation about how a business process ought to behave. It's not a building, it's not a garden, it's not like a, you know, edifice or anything like a, you know, it's its own thing. It is language that executes, which is awesome. We have never had a substance like this before, but we have to recognize that it is its own thing. It's unprecedented. You can't call it. There's no metaphor for it. It's idiomatic, idiosyncratic. It's its own damn thing. So yeah, I mean, the notion of iteration, the problem is we're iterating at the like micro level. So we're like, you know, we've got a magnifying glass and some tweezers out here. And what happens is all this sort of detritus that gets piled up ends up in the final product. And the reason that I see for that is it's this sort of bifurcation of the technical interests with the business interests, and then of course there's the design interest, the desirability interest that's been, you know, trying to dig its way in over the past few, you know, decade and change. So yeah, that's sort of my notion on the iteration part. Now that we're still, though, financing this stuff and managing and staffing this stuff like it's an industrial project. So we've kind of containerized the production part of it, and we've taken the waterfall module out and we've tossed it away, and then we plug in the container of the agile module, but the interface to that is still. It's still industrial age. You know, when you look at it, it's like, just say, for example, you know, any thing with a budget, you know, you say, okay, well, I want to deliver a product and it's going to be, you know, I'm going to spend $1 million on it and it's going to be done in 6 months. And like, I don't, you know, we do this, whatever it is, it's done in 6 months. And, you know, whatever we've got in 6 months is going to be what we sell. Does anybody else do that? You know, I don't know. I mentioned this, and especially in industrial stuff, and this is something that I've just borrowed from Cooper, is there's this massive negative feedback in an industrial project. If you screw up the plans to a building, it costs you an order of magnitude to fix. If you're a couple microns off of a piece like the back of a cell phone or something like that, you blow the entire run. You know, we don't have that for software. We don't have this flaming wreck that we can point at and like shame people with. You know, you screwed this up. Right. You know, you cost us all this money. You can't do that. It's more like a, you know, this sort of decay that happens, and like years and years later. And we see this, like Friendster is my favorite example of this. It's a company that made a product that was like, you know, you couldn't really tell how bad it was until it started piling on people, and then it really, really started to suck. And then they went and they lost that to MySpace, which was actually an inferior product, in my opinion. You know, they, again, MySpace, the same thing. They decayed and decayed and decayed. And it's like the entropy of, you know, it's like the second law of software thermodynamics, is the entropy just comes in. And the entire thing dies. And like, I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing happened to Facebook, frankly. And it seems the only people that are resistant to that are Google, because they factor that in at the outset.
Yeah. Well, a colleague of mine, Chris Avori, commented on Twitter today to a post on the Washington Post about someone writing about at the end about how Facebook will eventually become so ubiquitous in a way that it'll be about as remarkable as your telephone ringing. I would argue that we're already there with that, personally. I think that, you know, there's nothing remarkable about being on any social network, really, anymore, because everybody's on it. So, you know, the value behind these tools, as I've talked about before many times, is the ability to connect you with other people in the real world. So, but with the post-industrial revolution, sort of philosophies around everything you're describing, whether it's programming languages or whatnot, I think the bigger challenge is to understand, like, the notion of return on investment for most people and the stuff that we're creating, because it's not a product, it's not a tangible product like the water bottle I'm holding. How do you define the value behind it, right? And how do you know, how do you get buy-in for these things, even at a program, like, I'm not a programmer like yourself in that agile community, but I've been learning from the agile community over the last year or so, and I'm still at a point where, like you said, like, sort of the waterfall method is doesn't work anymore because we're not building a car. It's not part A to part B. But at the same time too, it's sort of like, well, even with Agile, yeah, but we're still creating the same project, if I'm understanding you correctly. We're still creating a product, but we're just using a different process to get to that end state. But even then, the end state keeps shifting and changing and evolving.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't.
That's
Okay.
no, it doesn't. And
Okay.
this is actually something that just completely bothers the hell out of me. But there's another thing that I want to talk about too.
Cool.
But first, I'll just cover this. Now, we say that the requirements keep changing. This is why we have to react to it. Lies, okay? That is, there's a category of stuff that changes very, very quickly, indeed. You know, you can like take your entire dependency tree of software and like guaranteed there's going to be micro revisions in each of those multiple times a day. And that is, you know, yeah, trying to keep up on that, forget it. You know, then there's going to be a new company releasing some new product and new API, blah. Okay, I don't care about products. I cannot afford to keep track of products. There's just too damn many of them. Journalist Stuart Brand, have you ever heard of him?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry.
Stuart Brand, Whole Earth Catalog. He had a book and a documentary about 20 years ago called How Buildings Learn. It's on Google Video. I highly recommend watching it. He's got a concept in there called shearing layers, and he went on to the Long Now .org project. Same notion. You've got, imagine like an orrery. Do you know it's like a one of those planet model things from like the Renaissance. And it's got like all these gears and crazy crap on it. And you know, you've got planets going slowly, you got planets going quickly, you can do all sorts of astronomical calculations with it. Now, there's a category of stuff that moves very, very slowly. The notion of shearing layers is divided into six parts. I believe it's like sight, structure, skin, services, space plan stuff. I'm not reading, I got a blank piece of paper here. Okay. So, and he's talking about it with respect to architecture. So now the site is like you can have multiple buildings on a site over millennia. Structure is, you know, you can have a structure, and talks about like the New College of Oxford when it was made in 1379. They're talking about these timbers and the Great Hall and how they were full of the beetles, you know, and they needed to replace the timbers. And so they go to the arbor and they say, you know, do we have any trees, oak trees, big enough? And they're like, oh yeah, we planted some 500 years ago in anticipation of this. Like, how cool is that? You know, and then you've got the skin of a building that you'll replace every, you know, few decades, and the services within the building that they get replaced as they get obsolete, and the space plan moves around. So you've got this hierarchy of time scales of things to pay attention to. So there's stuff that indeed moves very, very quickly, but that's just the crust of it. And if you concentrate more on the stuff that moves slowly, you know, like demographics moves very slowly, you know, the economic trends move relatively slowly, you know, and just sort of like just the zeitgeist, just what people care about, moves relatively slowly. And then what happens is like if you live down there, and then when you want to start talking about creating something of value, then you kind of start moving up and you come into sync with the faster moving stuff until you hit it. And that's when you release your product. It's like, I don't have to care about the micro revision of some module that some guy wrote because, you know, whether or not it works with my stuff, because I will deal with that when I've decided you know, how I want to do that. So when I apply that to something like user experience design and information architecture and whatever the hell I call it these days.
Yep, I'm with you. Carry on. Yep.
When I apply that, I think about, you know, like I start out and I'm like, okay, well, who are the people in the business ecosystem here? You know, that changes very, very slowly. You know, then I look at, you know, individual interactions, and then, you know, then we start to flesh out what the system needs to do. And the chances are that's going to be independent of whatever implementation you decide to use. We don't have to run around, you know, reacting to plans, changing and stuff like that. It's just like, I mean, that stuff, the fast moving stuff can torpedo your entire project if you don't sort of pay attention to it. But, you know, again, like, it's a question of sort of when you start having to pay attention to it.
Yeah, so is it more a matter of trying to get organizations then, if I'm understanding you correctly, to slow down instead of trying to chase every single, like you were talking about the ideas of, you know, iteration and incrementalization and whatnot. I mean, we're so wrapped up in every little detail. I mean, you can even look at Twitter, for example. I mean, you can get on there and, man, you can waste 3 hours on Twitter just following every little detailed conversation. And I'm wondering, and a lot of people I've talked to over the years too, they're talking about the pace at which technology is moving. And is your argument then, if I'm understanding correctly, we shouldn't try to be bothering to keep up with technology all the time, but looking at these slower moving elements in terms of being able to say, well, let's keep focused on that prize, because if we keep trying to iterate through a design thousands of times over, we're never going to be able to produce anything?
Oh, we waste massive amounts of time and money doing that. And they do, and I've seen it. You know, I've like personally added up, like, you know, holy shit, like this entire endeavor took, you know, $1.5 million just on people's salaries. Why? You know, it didn't need to. It probably could have been done in like $50,000, you know. And like, I'm looking at this kind of insanity, and it's like, well, why do we do this? Well, we didn't have conceptual integrity. We did not have cohesion. And, you know, we were just trying to chase every little bit and piece. I kind of look at that and I'm just like, it's not a matter of speed. But we have to kind of understand the physical limitations of our own, like, information processing capacity. There's a physics to information that we kind of assume that we're already informed. Like, even the notion of expertise, for instance, it assumes that we already know. You know, leave everything to me, you know, this sort of service economy, let me get that for you kind of behavior that's, you know, just, and I think the thing is we can't capacitate that anymore. There's too many problems. They're too hard. We need a little bit more participation than the best and the brightest can offer us. There's just simply not enough time, brain time on their part to do it. So I kind of want to dispatch the idea of you know, being in highly accredited expert, and that's possibly, you know, bias on my part.
No, no, no. I totally agree with you. Like, the universe, I have what, 1, 2, 3 degrees, and they're not worth the paper they're printed on. They're not. I mean, well, they're not, because there's a massive leap in what you were saying, Dorian. There's a massive leap between knowledge and understanding. And that divide, the huge difference, right? You can know about, and I've argued this before in presentations I've given, you can know about literally anything today. You know, literally, but to literally create that understanding, the divide between knowledge and understanding in my world anyway is experience. You need to be able to experience that. You need to be able to have many different experiences to get that broader perspective to understand something. I had a professor in university that it was a moral and ethics class. And, you know, they said, you know, we were bringing up issues like abortion and euthanasia and really hot button topics for most people. And he said, you know, we wrote our names down and said, you know, pick which you agree with. And then we had to write papers that argued the opposite side of the argument that we agreed with. And it was the hardest thing you ever read, right? Because I had to keep it to 500 words. And it was the most difficult thing I ever did, but it forced me to go from knowing about something to talking to people who had the opposite opinion of me to being able to get that bigger picture so that I could, in fact, because if you can't argue the other side of an argument, whether it's design, whether it's philosophy, whether it's science, whatever, if you can't look at the opposite end of that spectrum and argue that just as passionately and knowingly, You know, it's the same thing that you're talking about with designs and all these other multiple iterations we go through, and the things that we really need to focus on, which are the things that aren't moving at, which, and the things that move at lightning paces these days are the fads, right? A fad comes and goes, it's here and it's gone, and then there's another app that does the same thing. But if we don't slow down long enough to look at that bigger picture and actually take the time to truly understand, then the arguments are really just, it's more about opinion than fact. It's more about insights and ideas than actual revelations that can cause people to create a kind of paradigm shift. And I'm not using that overly used word in a way that's sort of an expression of something, but the true definition of shifting your view of the world 180 degrees to look at it from a different point of view. And we don't do that anymore, I don't think.
First of all, we can't really, I mean, back to the sort of the best and the brightest and the expert type notion, it assumes that that there's a target, there's a patient, and they're inert. The user is a patient. They don't know what's up. They're helpless. And it's up to us to help them. It's very heroic, you know, rhetoric in there. And I think what we're realizing is we really need empathy in order to sort of really understand what we're doing. And it's like, it's kind of, I watched your presentation, not quantifiable one, just the other day. And is this, for instance, a story core that you brought up, you know, like, and so we're, but another sort of interesting element of that is how we're sort of changing from this notion of the sort of hierarchical organization of the best and the brightest at the top, the Brangelinas, the Napoleons, the Einsteins and whatever. And we're kind of realizing that, you know, everybody has a story. And there's also stuff that, like, you know, the sort of notion of quantitative intelligence and quantitative capacity, you know, being the fastest runner or the highest IQ or anything, like, really doesn't mean a lot anymore. And, like, everybody goes through this stuff. And so I think that's really, really kind of cool that we're starting to sort of breach that idea. But there's another thing, and again, another thing I wanted to touch on was the notion of, just back to speed and slowness, we're medium-sized creatures, right? And we only really understand medium-sized stuff. So we've got microscopes and telescopes to see small things and see faraway things. And we've got, you know, power lifters to, you know, and dump trucks and, you know, rockets and airplanes and stuff like that to sort of extend our physical capacities. But we really can't understand stuff that isn't medium size. And so back to sort of, instead of saying making things slower, I want to say more like, you know, if it ain't medium size, don't pay attention to it. If it's a medium size projection of non-medium size phenomena, then you can pay attention to it. Because this stuff is not linear, right? Like, it just kind of explodes out and it's very, very difficult to especially when you're very at the tip of a non-linear phenomenon, and you go one more deep and you realize, like, how completely insanely complex it is, and we're really bad at that. We're really, really bad at non-linear explosions of complexity, and that's kind of where we're at now, you know. And we kind of have to linearize it. We kind of have to take the derivative of it and be like, okay, well, we're just going to look at that because we can't even capacitate it. There was also something you said that was really interesting with respect to ROI. I like that a lot. Instead, there is no such thing as ROI. And this is something that's been bothering me because, you know, we've been dealing with this in design. Like, how do you sell this, you know? And it's like, okay, well, what's the ROI of a solved problem, you know? What's the ROI of, like, something that somebody had to do that sucked and now they never, ever have to do it again? Yeah. I don't know how you could quantify that. But, again, we're kind of back into, like, nonlinear space. It's like, how do you save 30 seconds on your entire staff for the rest of their existence, the rest of your company's existence?
Well,
I don't know.
Well, it's like the presentation I gave. You know, being human isn't about, you know, it's not about an equation. Now, mathematicians may disagree with me. Scientists may disagree with me. You can quantify what it means to be human or the essence of what makes us up. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't think you can. I don't think, like you're describing, I don't think it even matters, really, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like at the end of my presentation, you know, I said you never see a Brinks truck following a funeral procession, right? Like, it doesn't. Well, you could, well, Bill Gates maybe or whatever, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really, those things don't really matter. And I think we need to be a lot better at saying, for example, I don't know. In this day and age where we can know about anything, you know, you're talking about, you know, I love the analogy you're using about the medium, it's not medium size being medium size. We can't even begin to fathom what those ideas or solutions to problems might be that are either much, much larger than us. And even at the smallest level, the microscope level, the analogy used as well. I love that because look at some of like cancer and these other diseases we're trying to battle against. We're taking generations to try to figure cures for them. And it's beyond our comprehension almost to grasp these things because we're not at that level. Is that, am I understanding your analogy right or am I way off?
Yeah, well, okay, actually the cancer stuff is interesting because cell growth is a computation.
Yes,
okay?
Exactly.
You have to understand computation in order to understand something like how you cure cancer.
Right.
It was really interesting, actually, if you go back 10 years before the Human Genome Project was completed, and think about all of the media that happened around then. Like, remember in the 90s, I think there was that movie Gattaca, where they were talking about all this sort of notion about, and there was a bunch of other stuff about, like, is there a gene for this, is there a gene for that? And it just doesn't work like that. When the Human Genome Project was completed, we found out there isn't enough entropy in the genome to describe is there a gene for this and a gene for that. Like in the way that it works, and this, I mean, I'm not a geneticist, I don't understand this too well, but I understand that like you basically run DNA,
mm-hmm.
And the same thing with anything to do with cell growth is you basically you run it as a computation. And then a bunch of stuff emerges from that. So I think that in order to understand, so what we were doing was we were sort of attacking these kinds of problems with a pre-computation understanding of the world. We can't, and because if you ever look at, you know, like a cellular automaton, it starts off as like a sort of a Genesis shape or whatever, or a fractal, for example. You start off as an initial shape, and then it folds and it moves over time. And the idea that something can change over time, but it can change over time and leave no evidence of what was behind it,
mm-hmm.
is something that because we're just looking at the state of something as it is now, but we sort of need to get an intuition, I think, for how. And it's like trying to explain evolution to a creationist, for instance. It's like how, you know, this sort of notion of Mount Improbable, as Dawkins puts it, that you know, all you got to do is you just got to take some stuff and then just run it. You know, you take some basic physical principles and just run it over a billion trillion iterations, and you get interesting stuff. And you don't need, like, Conway's life is a really good example of that. You know, you get extremely complex behavior coming out of a very, very simple rules. Another one's called Boyds, and it's fake flocking birds, and it's just a three rules in a physical, with plus actual physics of a 3D space. Another one is a Breitenberg vehicle, which is just a two neurons attached to two wheels in a cross formation that follows light, you know, and it looks like a cockroach. You'd never be able to tell. You make a tiny little John von Neumann, one of the sort of pioneering computer scientists, I believe he said, with four parameters I can fit an elephant, with five I can make him wiggle his trunk. I mean, this is the kind of, we've got a little tiny notion here with this massive range of activity that can be had from it. And I mean, it'd be really, really cool to start really capturing that stuff.
Yeah.
And really making that idea work for us. And that's kind of what I'm about. You know, this sort of division of labor between people and computers and whatever happens after computers.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and I'm loving this conversation because I'm always looking for people to talk about things that move beyond, you know, the like a lot of the conferences I've gone to over the last few years, like a lot of the topics are the same. Like we're talking about things like the IA Summit. You know, I've been to the last three, and there's always someone talking about a content inventory, like why it's important to do a content inventory. But it's more, and it's not that there isn't value behind that. There is. You need to know what the hell's on the site, for example, to understand how you're going to interact with things. But it's more about understanding this higher level, like you're talking about. I love the notion that you talked about with respect to the idea of, you know, empathy is really important. Because you know, when you're designing for other people, you have to. I think we forget about that. I think we've, you know, that was the whole purpose behind the Kai talk that I gave, was the fact that we need to step away from our computers and interact with other people. And if you don't know how to communicate with other people in the real world, you know, get comfortable in your parents' basement, because that's where you're going to be living for the rest of your days. Because if you can't have intelligent debate with people outside of a Twitter stream, which is only 140 characters anyway, or commenting on a blog post by putting your name up James123 and saying, you know, you're a fucking idiot and your ideas are stupid, well, you're not contributing to the conversation. Adam Connor at MadPow and Ella Zoller's race recently gave a talk about the difference between critique and criticism. There's a big difference between those two things. A critique is saying, I don't agree with you, and here is my experiences as to how I would approach the problem. A criticism is, okay, well, that's just fucking stupid, and walking away. Right? We need to evolve the conversation. We need to evolve the ideas beyond whether or not, like you said, they'll fit onto a 1024 by 768 screen. That's not interesting. You know, we can literally do almost anything with technology. Anything you see on any website, we can do. This is what I tell clients all the time. Yeah. They ask me, can we do these things? Well, where did you see it? I saw it on a site. Then the answer is, yes, we can do that. But beyond that, what is your larger term goals? Just like with social media. Well, we want to get into social media. Well, what is your longer term business objectives? What are the people needing, wanting, right? Well, they don't know. Well, then don't hire some social media quote unquote expert to come in and help you with that. Because, you know, Eric Ries pointed out to me at the summit this year, works for Fat Ducks in Copenhagen. He said, you know, we can, what was he saying? He was talking about this notion that, you know, we can literally do anything, but if you can't connect with other people, you know, in a meaningful way, not meaningful to the business, meaningful to the people with whom you're trying to communicate, then ultimately anything you create is useless. He was saying social media tools are free, right? But to have someone in-house to continually communicate and get feedback from those people, that's a lot of money, and it's also a lot of time, because you have to be able to communicate that message in a way that makes sense. We have departments in our own government here in Canada that I think they're revolutionary because they're writing blogs, but then you look at the bottom of the post, they've got like 12 caveats as to what they will or will not respond to, what they will or will not post, and people are afraid of getting this feedback that's negative. It's like, no, like, you need to understand that in the context of this bigger picture, because you're going back to your ideas about empathy and how part A put into part B doesn't always make part C. These are the bigger issues we need to be addressing, and you can't be fearful of negative feedback. I don't know how you learn, Dorian. I learn by screwing up. And, dude, I make more mistakes in a given week than most people do in a month. So, I don't know.
I got to suck at something really, really badly for like a fairly long time. And then it's kind of like, you know, and then it's like, I know Kung Fu. And then I can kind of really start to kick ass at it. But like, I have to really, really suck at it for like an arbitrary period of time. Like, you know, there's some stuff that I don't know if I'm going to live to master, but that's fine. But what I want to say about the something that I've been working on recently, right? Okay, it's the attitude of big organizations and this sort of we've got this awesome tension going on between the industrial age and the post-industrial age. It's happening all over the place, and I love it and hate it at the same time, because you know it's hampering my ability to perform, but you know, I know I'm going to win. I'm sucking at it right now, but I know I'm going to kick ass at it eventually. And it goes a little something like this. I mean, I'm looking back at the Industrial Revolution, mechanical power on demand. Before the steam engine, if you wanted something earth moved, you had to get a guy to do that. And then that stopped. And like, holy crap, was that ever awesome? That changed the notion of meaning political power. you know, a gun to somebody's head, a big sack of money, or whatever, you know, a carrot or a stick, that changed the having political power to just having money. You know, can you buy a steam shovel or something like that?
Right.
You know, and that was like, holy wow. And it also changes like an ongoing operational expense to a capital expense. What that did is broke the linear relationship between production capacity and demand. So meaning that, like, you know, you can, if you go and you build a factory, you've got this missing, you've got this, all this production capacity with this missing demand. More to the point, it just became really, really cheap and easy to just make tons of stuff. So we've got this, and it's sort of this idea that I'm exploring around packaging now, how it's a communication device. And it's emissive. It's like this, we've developed over the last, you know, we've refined to like a massive extent over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 decades or so, this idea of this sort of perfect cold call, which is really what something like packaging is. It's a perfect cold call. You know, it's like, it's pretty, you know, it looks nice, it doesn't smell bad, you know, it's light.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing is, that kind of stuff pervades into, just say like look at your average resume and the inflation, the inflation of academic credentials. You know, you can't get a bachelor's anymore. It's not good enough. You have to get a master's or a PhD now. That's like an additional, you know, N years of school, depending on the program. And now you're in your late 20s, you know, assuming you've done this entire thing end to end, before you can even entertain the idea of having a career. And then when you go, you've got this like smarmy cover letter with this hermetically sealed resume, and you tender it to the, you know, and the same thing happens with corporate communication too, like you were saying with the blogs and the 12 caveats of the things. Now, everybody's so shit scared that they're gonna say the wrong thing. Now, there's a good reason to do that, especially if you're at the head of a company and you say the wrong thing, and people, you take that as marching orders. So you want to watch out for that. But on the other end of it, you know, we've got all of these sort of delegates, agents that are communicating on behalf of us, and you really can't control what they're going to say. And having a person in that position that actually, first of all, knows what to talk about, knows what not to talk about, you know, and just sort of operates on a self actualized decorum, as opposed to like this wagging finger. But it's just like, it's such a mess. Like the organizations that got big and got successful during that hermetically sealed, packaged, max produced, you know, cold call period.
Yeah.
They completely are just completely disheveled and cannot deal with what we've got right now, which is sort of this egalitarian, colloquial, vernacular, whatever you want to call it, you know, this conversation that we, you know, that we can just have as people. You know, you can't just have somebody be like, oh yeah, you know, you've got a problem with that product. Why? Because it's a mass-produced product and we actually don't have time for you. You know,
yeah.
It's same thing with IVRs, you know. A friend of mine has this this axiom, or maxim, I should say, that he says, never take no for an answer from somebody who doesn't have the authority to say yes.
Right.
You know, and the IVR is like the ultimate anti-example of that. It's sad that we've sort of gotten to this point. And I listened to the podcast Planet Money on NPR, and they open with this ad for Ally Bank, what they say is that you've got the opportunity to speak to a customer care advocate 24 hours a day. What the hell is a customer care advocate? What does that person do? Do they just they kind of console you? They're like, oh, they're sorry about that overdraft fee or something like that. You know, what do they do? You know, can they help you at all? No, they're just sort of this like care advocate. So they, what? I can't even begin to interpret that.
Well, apparently they're trying to work on the empathy angle, right? So
yeah.
But
yeah.
At the same time, you're right. Like, it doesn't, I mean, it's kind of like you said, the product's finished. It's not like the person you're talking to can do anything about making the changes to the product. All they're doing is collecting the data to give it back to the corporation to see whether or not they can make changes. But is it, like you said, if you don't see any changes to the product and they aren't listening to the community, which is their source for revenue, right? Mm-hmm. Then ultimately, the only way that kind of company survives in this day and age is if it's a product or a service that people can't live without. Hence why in Canada, Rogers, hence like why Rogers and Bell don't ever change anything and do anything because, well, they don't have to because they're a monopoly. On the other hand, if it is something that people do need to or can change and they don't see changes to it, then the product disappears, or if they can make the change. And that's the thing, like, it doesn't take much to stand out if you're a business today. You just have to do the little things that allow you to connect with other people in the real world, in my experience anyway, that differentiate you. It's not like you got to spend tons of money. I saw a great quote the other day. Someone said, if you're not prepared to look stupid, you're never going to create anything great.
You know, I saw that too.
You know, if you're not, so it might have been a quote from the TV show House, but in any event, regardless, it's right. It's not about getting it right out of the box. We're not developing Super Bowl ads. It's not about spending $1 million on one thing and cracking it out, right?
It's not like a moonshot. Like that's, I mean, this is kind of the way that this stuff is all architected. Is it's like this, you know, this massive superstructure that we're just going to launch, you know, and we even use that language. We say, you know, product launch, and it's like launch, you know, like is it an ICBM? And it is. They say target market. You know, the interesting, the amusing thing about that is they actually don't have a lot of information. The amount of attention that any one producer has for any one consumer is nil. And with the breadth of all the things that you can buy, the amount of attention that I have as a consumer for any one product and any one producer, very, very low as well. But that's like seriously turning on its head, and you see that with like supply chain stuff, you know, issues, and like, you know, where are your minerals coming from in your supply chain? Like, holy crap! The sweatshop stuff from Nike, even decades ago. But like, I think the thing is, it's so easy to forget that commerce is a social thing. Like, commerce is somebody having the confidence to say, yes, I think what that is worth portion of my collected effort to trade with, for, you know, that's something that I value, you know, and that's something that people do. It's not this sort of robotic, impersonal transaction that just kind of magically sort of happens out in the ether somewhere. This is something that people voluntarily do, and that's the other part too. It's voluntary. They have to want to do it, and you know, you can dissimulate. You can trick people. You can hedge their thinking by just bombarding the crap out of them with stimuli. But you know, if anybody ever sort of steps out of Plato's cave and rubs their eyes and looks around, they're going to be like, "Why am I even bothering with this? why do I need, you know, another?" I don't know, gadget. I have plenty. What's going to happen there, I think, is that, you know, this sort of, this sort of rational dichotomy of producers and consumers, and we're already seeing this with makers and whatnot. You know, like you can get like a CNC machine or whatever and just make stuff. You know, just hackers in general. We're seeing ordinary people are becoming producers. It's one of the byproducts of the fact that you just don't need a crap load of capital to do stuff anymore. You don't need several million dollars to build a factory to pump out widgets, because you can just, you know, you can just make it in your bedroom if you felt like it. And that is like ridiculously huge. And when we get to start making physical things that way, when you don't have to go to the store and buy something, you just download the plans for whatever you want and you just pump it out of your 3D printer sitting in the garage. Holy crap, that's going to be nuts. So I think if we ever nail this idea of how to successfully interact and be, you know, proactive market participants, as opposed to these sort of like, you know, on the teat of this sort of massive machine, then I think that really, really interesting stuff is going to happen. That there's, since there's so much going on, and that we're actually having to start getting really judicious with what we do with our attention, like the cellular automaton, you know, like the simple constructs that with a few rules, and you change one rule, and holy crap, you get an entirely different thing. It's like a twisting a kaleidoscope or something like that. I guess when I see that, like I imagine, like what would happen if everybody just got a little bit pickier about what they paid attention to? Could Facebook survive? Could Twitter survive? You know, could TV survive? Could Hollywood survive? You know, could Apple?
And it's a great point, because I mean, one of the negatives I see in things like Twitter, for example, is, like I was saying before, it's only 140 characters, mm-hmm. and it almost produces this lemming society effect, right? And people are getting fired over what they say on Twitter.
Yeah.
Literally, I mean, to me, I look at that and I feel horrible for the person that lost his or her job. On the other hand, my initial reaction is, You've got to be fucking kidding me. Somebody's losing their job over what they say. Like, what they say in on Twitter, I mean, even if it's like, and it's that divide, like that kaleidoscope idea. If I say something about a company on my account during office hours, is that using office time? But am I allowed to express an opinion at 9 o'clock at night about something related to the company that's frustrating me? And does that count? Does that count towards what I'm saying? And it's almost creating this sort of click, like followers. It's almost like this sort of almost blind following towards a specific individual because they wrote a book or because they presented at a conference and somebody liked it. And therefore, if that person liked it, well, we need to follow this. And I'm wondering whether or not, I'm not saying it is, but I'm wondering whether or not this is almost creating a sense where people are stopping or they're not thinking critically anymore. They're just sort of following the lead of whatever the people they like on Twitter, and that's creating this sort of disconnect in the real time relationships when you meet them in the real world, so to speak.
So, reasoning costs us, like critical thought costs, and it's cheaper in this space for us to just not think and just be like, oh yeah, you know. Have you ever heard of the Matthew effect?
I have not.
It's when, it's when memes or any sort of, it started off in the scientific community that the papers that had a lot of, were made by popular people got popular, and the ones that didn't, did not. So like the haves got more and the have-nots. So that is like, we should just treat that as physics. You know, the physics of information and intention. We should just treat it like that. That's just how stuff works. Okay. Now, there are ways of dealing with that, but we should expect that, you know, the existing amount of the attention that's already pointed in one direction is going to gravitate toward that direction. So the people that have a lot of attention, we can assume they're going to get more. Now, basically, the only way that you can really deal with that is by, like, you know, launching a hand grenade into the space to get some attention for yourself. You know, it really has to be pretty drastic. Or, you know, you can actually chip away at it over time. Well, I don't know. I'm gonna.
No, I've launched the Dorian. I've launched the hand grenade at times, not to get more attention, but just try to shift the conversation or try to look at the other experience.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times, again, if it's something on the tool, again, this is why the tools are important to understand how you're communicating. 140 characters, context can get lost very, very quickly, rapidly, and the conversation can quickly deteriorate away from its original intent.
Yeah.
Right, so that's why I think it's also important to make sure you understand that as well. Like, there are certain things that you just shouldn't be talking about if you can't provide the context.
Like, you look at where it came from. It came from blogs. Now, the blog is a really interesting beast. It's like taking a word processor, and then the save button instantly publishes it to the rest of the planet. is that smart? You know, is that actually really, you know, is that really something you want to do? Is it really something you want to do in corporate communications? I mean, like the word processor has been bad enough on its own for dealing with corporate communications and document management. I mean, it's a freaking nightmare. There's an entire, you know, it's like a billion-dollar industry to clean up, you know, spearheaded by Microsoft to clear up the mess that they made themselves. Actually, I don't know about that figure, but I'd wager it's in the order of that.
Oh, and it's only going to grow in time because all we're doing is creating more data over and over again exponentially.
Yeah, but we're creating mud for data.
That's a much better way. Absolutely right.
The Microsoft Word format, it has no concept of semantics in there. You can't. There's no. It's just like a soup of text, completely worthless. And you know, it's like the holy grail of content strategy is to be able to mine those things and actually get content out of it. I actually, by the way, plug. I know how to do that. Anyway, the thing is, though, is when you take, but basically what we did is we took a word processor, we made a bad copy of it on the web, you know, the rich text editor, and then we pushed the save button is also the publish button. So you've got to write now and you've got to, and you can fix it later is basically is the method of it. And it's kind of interesting because it pervades, it crosscuts. It's also the same strategy that to do with Agile. It's, oh, we'll write the code now and then we'll fix it later. Yeah, except later never comes. And the same thing with, I absolutely think that there's a category of stuff that needs to be, we're talking about the environment, you know, with the grass and the trees and the birdies and stuff like that now.
Yep.
Okay, what about the data environment? You know, we're polluting the crap out of that. We're polluting that more than like a billion, you know, coal furnaces, you know, the equivalent of that. We are so just completely just dumping so much crap into that. And like our grandchildren are going to have to mine it. And the problem is the same thing with the problem of the fat man and Bill Gates. You know, one of those is going to skew the, and one of those is not going to skew the average in the former sense, but in the latter sense it is. You know, we're going to have the equivalent of an analog to the billionaire versus the working people, with data. Except we're going to, like, you know, we've got this entire space where this, I guess that's what I mean, is that we've got this entire space where this stuff can grow, and it can grow so huge. And, you know, we're not going to want to throw it away because, like, it might be worth something. And, you know, we're going to have, like, exabytes of this stuff, petabytes. I don't know. I can't remember how big they get. The zottabytes or whatever.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You know, and we're going to have, yeah, I mean, we're just polluting the crap out of it right now. And it's sad because, like, eventually we're just going to get to the point where it's like, ah, screw it, nuke it.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
and we're going to lose our history and our memory because of that and our technology because of that. It's going to be garbage.
Well, I remember I've told clients many times, I'm like, well, let's talk about the purpose of your technologies, whether it's a website, whether it's a prototype, whether it's a product, whatever. And then they debate about it. I'm like, okay, well, the essence of your website or your messaging or whatever is this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then if that's your purpose for what this tool is about, then 90% of the content that exists within the tool doesn't fit within that overall objective, so we need to throw it away. Well, we can't throw it away. Well, then, like you said, well, then archive it. But then you also have to talk to them about the appropriate method of archiving it. But the point being is that if you have several million pages on a website for bigger corporations, I mean, how much of that is being accessed and being valued by the people for whom you're designing? If you don't know that question, the answer to that question, then you shouldn't be looking at adding more and more or creating the next widget or the next tool. You should be trying to find the answer to that question, which is, I think, the crux of a lot of what we're talking about in this particular podcast, getting down to that essence of being able to slow down long enough to look at the things that slowly change over time so that you can address the question in the right way, such that you can get the answers, not necessarily that you want to hear, but the answers to the questions that you need to hear. And so the idea of going back to the tools again around the Canadian government, for example, and certain blogs only publishing certain things. Look, you need to be able to get the negative feedback to understand what people want, especially in a public service role, for example, because your job, professional politics aside, is to work for me. I'm paying, you and I are paying the salary of the public servants that are doing this job. So if you're not prepared to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly, then you're not going to be able to effectively create solutions for me. And in some cases, it may not be a technical solution at all. And I think we've gotten to the point where almost a lot of technology is almost a crutch or a sort of a scapegoat to say, well, I'm accountable because it's online. But if I can't find the goddamn information, then you're not accountable. It's buried somewhere, and it's written in a language, and I'm not talking English, French, because Lord knows I don't want to get in that debate. I'm talking about in a way that I, as an average Canadian citizen, can understand it, right?
Yeah.
And so if you can't do that, then, well, you're not really providing a solution.
There's a few forces at work there. And again, I think there's an element of obscurantism anyway that you're going to see like in any large entity,
of course,
it's like ecclesiastical Latin, you know. it's been made not necessarily consciously, but it certainly has been advantageous to create a language that other people don't understand, because you can talk to one another in your in-group and not have the out-group know what you're saying. And that is an extremely useful source of power, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, dude, I hear you, absolutely. And at the end of the two, I was interesting, what you're talking about relates to two issues I've been writing about for the last little while, which is the issues of trust and control. You know, I think a lot of the work that I do is sort of moderating discussions between what I call the affectionately the gray hairs, in other words, the baby boomers and the kids coming into the industry now, where the boomers have always been able to control the messaging, as you've alluded to throughout this discussion, versus the younger generation coming in that has grown up in a world where they can share and have access to anything they really want. And so, you know, when you're living in a world, when you grow up in a world where you can control the messaging, control the statements, the conversation across the board, and then in the last decade be having to give up control of the conversation and to be able to trust the people that are trying to give you feedback about how to best do it better the next time. I think that's one of the biggest problems in terms of a lot of the stuff that you've been describing is this massive shift. It's a shift in a corporate culture. It's a shift in the mentality of how to do things. You're going from generations working in one career for one company their entire lives, generally in the same role, in the same corporate culture for sure, to a generation that says, well, you know, I care less about money and retirement than I do about fame and making sure that my voice is heard and being able to share ideas and debate. And that's a big shift from, that is literally, in my understanding of the term, that is a paradigm shift from going from one way of doing business and communicating and sharing ideas, what that is completely controlled, moderated, and sort of almost to a de facto standard, to one where the conversation is completely wide open, people are sharing ideas and experiences, and ultimately you don't have to put your name to anything if you don't want to. And that's a massive shift in the way in which you think, the way you communicate, the way you share ideas. And as we talked about before, your degree, your title. I mean, I've been debating forever that your title is just such bullshit. I mean, I can call myself the social media expert. I can call myself the communications professional. I can call myself the information architect, the user experience designer. I've never understood how people can call themselves user experience designers if they don't at least take a passing interest in behavioral and cognitive psychology. If you're designing for other, that's like me saying I'm an expert in programming because I read an HTML book. Are you kidding me? How the hell does that? How do you do that? I don't get how you get a. I don't understand how you qualify yourself as that. I mean, the ultimate, of course, is the social media expert.
Okay.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry, man. I'm rambling.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to talk about that, actually, that sort of that element there, and I seriously think it has to do with the economics of information. I got three ideas, and it's something that I'm really, really in the sort of preliminary stages of trying to put together, and they kind of don't really have an orientation. They're kind of, you can take them in any order you want, and that is that the surfeit of precursors, the principle of one degree, and the expedient desirable product. Now, the expedient desirable product is something that I can produce that has value, and I can do it in a day.
Okay.
I can sit down and I can just make it happen And the reason why I can make it happen is because of the principle of one degree. And that's one degree of conceptual complexity. So I don't have to go deep, I just go broad. Anything in my vicinity is the determinant for being able to make one of these products. Now, the idea that's going to cause a bunch of elements in my immediate vicinity is this sort of notion of a surfeit of precursors. Okay, I grew up with a lot of Lego. I see it. Okay, and like within my reach, I could any piece, and so I have to dig for 10 minutes. You know, and there it is. I saw crap. It fell out. Anyway, I had the means to make whatever I wanted all around me at all times. And I would come up with patterns and techniques that I would feed back into the system to have more possible combinations of elements. So if I can make a thing a day, and I can throw it into my inventory of parts, and as that grows, and this was a Doug Engelbart idea with respect to bootstrapping, where you've got the Baron Munchausen pulling up himself by his bootstraps and like floating up. I don't know if you saw that Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess the way that I sort of see that is we go. It's a computational process. It's a self-generating process. It's a fractal process. And if I can do that, then eventually there will be a day that I have this one massive piece, this one massive piece, and I just go chunk, done, sell it. And that I think is really, I think that's the template for the way to deal with complex business. And so what you say is, you know, we're not treating this as a big capital expense now. We're treating it as an operating expense. So, you know, whatever it takes to get me my ramen noodles, you know, is all I need in the interim until I have, you know, one of these objects. So whatever I have to do that, you know, and you can see that, like, there's a lot of organic incubators that are sort of popping up every here and there. And Maya Design, actually, interesting one. They have a company, and then they just carve off a piece of the company to become a spin-off company. So it's a sort of generator. It's a factory for companies. You know, the purpose of business is profit. As a maxim, is actually relatively new. The increased shareholder value, that was Jack Welch in like 1980 saying that. But we take that as gospel, like it's always existed. And it's actually not really the case. Like if you think about, going back to what you were saying about how, like, you know, you work for me kind of thing, with government, and the same thing with corporations too. Their bread and butter is, again, it's a voluntary social process of saying, I value this, I will pay you, you know, for a piece of your product. They die if people don't value them. You know, GM, for instance, is not propped up. But like, really, honestly, how about entertaining the concept that nobody wants to buy freaking Pontiacs anymore?
Yeah,
I know I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and the other thing too, I mean, listening to the community and the global economy and everything else that's going on, the environment's huge. I mean, and yet it costs $10,000-$15,000 more for a hybrid than it does for a normal car. Well, why are, for example, then why aren't the hybrids costing as much or less than the gasoline guzzlers? Well, because the economy's still driven by the fuel industry, right? So, you know, you have to balance that out. Plus, I mean, it's also looking at the larger global picture. The reality is the global economy's in the tank. We've never experienced anything like this before. One country's been in a global collapse in terms of their economy or whatnot, or they're in a recession or whatnot. We've never experienced anything like this on a global scale. And we can't just shut down the oil industry, because then, guess what? You know, the Middle East, what have they got in terms of profit margin, in terms of anything to sell of value or of that's viable to the rest of the global community? They have nothing. It's a freaking desert.
If we didn't trade embargo them, we'd
probably do that. There you go. Yeah.
I think, though, I mean, looking at this stuff, the kind of the discourse that I've been following, actually a good guy to follow on this is Amir Hack.
Okay.
He kind of gets a little Apple fanboy every once in a while, but we're looking at this sort of what they call as a jobless recovery. And I think what I see is happening is almost like plate tectonics of just ways of doing stuff. There, it's like this rift, and it's kind of like starting to. It goes back to this sort of notion of like, okay, imagine if just entertain this, and I'm not saying this is actually happening because I have no way of knowing this, but like imagine that people are actually recognizing that this stuff is a freaking Ponzi scheme. You know, people are recognizing like, you know, hey, Peter Drucker again. Back in the 50s is basically like, okay, the knowledge worker owns his means of production. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean? It means that, you know, the money out there is fungible as hell. I can either take your money or your money or your money. The problems and the brain power to solve the problems, not fungible, okay? the scarce resource is that. It's not iron ore, it's not cash, it's not oil, it's freaking cognition. And if you told somebody, you know, hey, you know, you own your means of production, you know, just like, for example, if you're at the office and then, you know, and your contract says something like whatever you create at the on site belongs to us kind of thing. Okay, I'm typing into a computer. I could just as easily type into my computer.
Yes.
I could use, you know, I could use anybody's, you know, I could use my own, you know, it's a commodity. It's not important, you know, so I don't need your special equipment in order to do this stuff. I don't need you to buy, you know, truckloads of material, because the material comes in here and here, and it comes out here, and it can happen anywhere. And I think we're not really prepared. We haven't really had a lot of discourse around that, you know. And what I want to see, I guess, is a lot of I want to see at least my brain. We can discuss, you know, we can discuss how much that is worth, mm-hmm. You know. I'm not going to try to just like throw out arbitrary numbers out there, but like, you know, what we're doing here is we're leasing my brain to solve problems. And the value of that is going to be whatever it costs to do that. And we can discuss, you know, we can move incrementally forward. We can say, I cogitate this stuff for a bit. I send it back to you. You go, you know, yes, I value this. Continue. Or no, here's a check. Get out of here.
Yep. It's your choice. I mean, I had that several years ago. I worked for a Crown Corporation here in Ottawa, actually, and I made a bet with the VP at the time, and I told him, I said, I'll bet you I can get more done in 5 days working from home than I could in an entire month going to meetings in and out of here. And he took me on my word, and he goes, okay, give it a shot. Well, by Wednesday, I was done. I got months worth of what they consider to be a month's worth of work done in 3 or 4 days, because the majority of my time was spent going to meetings, debating ideas. There was no tangible output. There was nothing. It was just back and forth. And I told him I was done on Wednesday. So does that mean I get to take Thursday, Friday to myself with pay? He's like, no, get in here and get back to your desk. But sitting at my desk at home, I was able to actually get more done. And I think that's another big shift for people, especially senior executives, that think, okay, well, if you're not at the bricks and mortar building, you're going to screw around. It's the same idea like within certain private and public sector organizations that block access to certain sites. It's
Oh my God, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, well,
it is so ridiculous.
Well, what's the point, right? Like, and the thing is, the things that are blocking sites, access to sites to certain things, are the way in which people are communicating, sharing ideas, sharing knowledge and experiences and whatnot.
Yeah.
And my argument is, you know what? If you've got employees that are spending 3 hours a day playing solitaire or visiting or on their Facebook page, maybe you should either A, remove the position and get rid of the individual if they're not adding value, or B, give them something to do that's going to challenge them, as you've pointed out. And I think it's more of the latter. It's about people not feeling challenged and valued enough in their organizations so that they can go and do meaningful work. Because if I'm spending 3 hours on Facebook every day, let me tell you, it's not to give, most of the time, it's not because people want to sort of tell the man to fuck off. I think it's more about telling the man, I'm bored out of my mind. Can you give me something to do? Because otherwise, I might as well go home and have a nap, right? At least that's been my experience, so.
I think that there's this narrative, and it goes back to the sort of the assembly line, mm-hmm. And I wrote this piece a while ago, and I put it up somewhere because I don't like allowing comments on my own space, but I put it up somewhere where there are comments. And it was about is employment the best model for creative work? Some of the comments that I got were like in the order of, well, if you don't crack the whip, nobody's going to do anything. And I'm like, how freaking disrespectful is that? You know, really? You know, you really think that? You think that these people are the people that are doing that, you don't know who they are. You know, they are sneakier than you are, okay? They are pros at doing that. And you're never going to, you know, it's not Bob sitting in the corner, you know, just like you said, bored out of his mind. I think that for knowledge work, the archetype we understand as employment is actually just really ineffective. We're not saying ineffective; it's just a really crappy deal. And the notion that you have to, you know, you're staying on task, you know, this sort of what is on task? We don't know what on task is anymore, especially if you have. You're the one with the most information about what you need to do. Who is it, anybody, to be able to tell you, you know, get back to work, you bum, is if your boss could evaluate your process, he wouldn't need to hire you because he could do it himself and it'd be cheaper to do it himself. And like the funny thing about this stuff is that when you delegate, you know, you delegate something that you can evaluate, right?
Yep.
Otherwise, you know, you gotta just be hands off. If somebody's in the middle of something, there's absolutely no way unless you know how to do this stuff yourself. But if you know how to do this stuff yourself, you're probably actually better off doing it yourself because there's no heavy lifting. You know, it's all by the time, especially with software, because by the time you've communicated what you want, and if you're capable of communicating what you want, you're done. The code is written. Because that is literally a description of what you want. Frederick Brooks has this notion called conceptual integrity. And conceptual integrity is the state of disambiguity. It's a state of everybody knows what part and what how the thing is supposed to be. And the way that you do that is you get exactly one person to have a coherent concept, because you can't have two people with half an idea.
All of these things that you're talking about, it's amazing. Like, these are the conversations that nobody ever has. These are the kinds of, they don't, because the reality is it's too hard, right? And you can say I'm accountable because I sent an email, and you can call it a day. But as you pointed out with Word, emails, another sort of mud knowledge management issue that we're all dealing with. But I think at the end of the day, I think that these are the kinds of conversations we need to be having more of. We need to be talking more about the value behind the people within organizations, because as I've talked about before, it's like a community of practice, right? As an example, without the community of practice is kind of useless, right? So I think we need to be focusing more on those things. And I don't think that the tagline that I use to end this show it could be any more appropriate than this particular conversation. In the sense that you know, it's really important. Wayfinding, or the ability to find everything quickly and easily, is so important. And Dorian, we could talk for hours, and I hope that we keep talking about these things, and I hope we stay connected in the weeks, months, and years ahead, because these ideas are critical to the foundation of success for everything that we do moving forward. And it also pushes us beyond the computer screen into the real world, and that's sort of the notion that that we really need to start focusing more on, is bringing technology and people together, but making sure that people, not just talking about user-centered design in the sense of putting the user front and center, but putting the larger field of endeavor and what people want at the press at sort of the forefront, so that we can move forward accordingly. So Dorian Taylor in Vancouver, thank you very much for joining me today on the IA podcast. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Until next time, I hope you can find everything you need whenever you need it. Take care.